Hey there, Kelly here. Guests on the show share so many great ideas, but how do you start putting them into practice? Well, that's exactly what you'll explore when you sign up for the Podcast Weekly Newsletter. Each week, you'll get 3 ideas from past guests sent straight to your inbox. You'll explore materials, techniques, tools, concepts, and mindsets in bite-sized pieces so that you can think about them and fold them into your own practice. It's completely free, and you get it by signing up at learntopaintpodcast.com/newsletter.
I think that really laid the groundwork for my love of a daily practice, because I feel like you said, you can just make something different tomorrow. It doesn't have to be that deep. It kind of takes the weight and the seriousness off of it so that you can play more. And I know it's different for everyone, but certainly for me, there has to be play and curiosity in my practice.
Hello and welcome to the Learn to Paint podcast, the show where we work to answer the question, how do you get better at painting? I'm your host, Kelly Ann Powers. And in this week's episode, I'm talking with the voice you just heard, Sari Shrike. In the conversation, you'll learn how to get started if you're low on time. And side note, joining the hashtag 20for20 Art Challenge 2022 might help you there also. What's important to ask yourself when it comes to finding your style, and a few places you can really push color. Plus a whole lot more. Gloss and High Gloss Patreon supporters, your bonus episode is ready, and in it we'll dive even further into bright colors, including how to approach your supporting characters so that your color can really sing. For show notes, head to learntopaintpodcast.com/podcast/episode40. While you're there, sign up for the newsletter list to get more ideas on how to get better at painting. And if you like the show and find yourself coming back week after week, consider supporting it. You can learn more at learntopaintpodcast.com/support by clicking the Patreon link. All right, here we go.
Hi, Sari. Welcome to the podcast. How did you get started in art?
Hi, Kelly. Thank you for having me on the show. Okay, how did I start in art? So I was always kind of an artsy kid, just doodling on things. And I love those drawing number books and stuff like that. But I grew up pretty low income. And so there weren't a lot of opportunity for special classes, or outside of like my mom getting crayons and watercolor, there wasn't a lot of fostering that. But I was always loosely artsy. And then in college, I was a student athlete and I had to pick a major. And I think naively, I thought that art would be an easier major. I was a little bit artistically inclined. Plus, I thought it would fit with being an athlete pretty well. So I picked art in an advertising type course. And so I took my Foundations of Art class with an amazing professor. His name's Todd Lowry. And he also happened to be the painting instructor. And I fell in love with this philosophy. He was such an amazing teacher. And basically, ever since I took his class freshman year, I have been painting ever since.
So you have been a full-time artist, or I guess you have been painting professionally since college.
Yeah. So right after I graduated, so 2014 was, that's the year I graduated, was a pretty big year for me. I not only graduated, but I got married that summer. And then we moved down to Austin from Springfield, Missouri for my husband's job. He was a sports writer. And then we found out we were pregnant all in that year. So it was a crazy year. And I hopped around random jobs. I did a little bit of freelance graphic design, some photography. I worked at a running store, just like odd jobs. But I was on kind of a maternity leave. I mean, I was just not working, basically, right after I had my son. And after he was 2 months old, I remember just feeling like I needed to start doing art or figure out if I even liked art. I was 23 and just really lost. And so January 1st of 2016, I started a 1 drawing/painting a day challenge for myself on Instagram. And it was really just for accountability. Like, I didn't let anyone I know follow me. It was just for myself. But that really snowballed. And so, yeah, since about 2018, I would say, I have been a professional full-time artist.
Okay, so you started daily painting. Were you working in acrylics then? How did you find acrylics specifically?
I painted with acrylics in college. That was the first time I ever painted with them. My painting professor, he was more classically trained. He got his master's at the School of Visual Art in New York, and he works in oil. But our college had really poor ventilation, and so we started painting with acrylics then. But it was very much in a style, a way of layering and working that was very close to oils. And so whenever I started my daily painting practice, actually, the fact that I didn't have a studio and I didn't have a lot of time, I was really just painting during my then 2 months old nap time. I almost called my account nap time art, actually. But because time was such a constraint, I started with just ink doodles and then watercolor, just a Crayola palette of watercolors, super, super meager. And then as that grew, took more time, it just kind of snowballed as that sort of thing does. I was able to build a little art studio in my one bedroom apartment. I took down my TV and entertainment center and I put up a drop cloth and I put a baby gate up and I started painting just on my wall. But that's when I was able to reintroduce acrylics. And I think that was August of 2016. So like 8 months into my daily painting.
So many guests on the show have talked about, they've said that daily painting or committing daily was like a really pivotal moment for them. And for you, what was it about showing up daily that made such a difference? Was it a skill thing or was it more like a how you prioritize your life thing?
It's a little bit of all of that. Certainly skill, you know, you can become rusty. And I think quite a bit of it is prioritizing your life. And when your partner and your family and people around you know, it's like, oh, you're going to go paint. You do it every day. I think that's helpful. But I think the core of it, honestly, is learning how to be comfortable with your own imperfections and lacking. Even now, I have a very big, robust painting practice. But even now with my painting practice, I'll show up and it's not always the best version of myself. I'll make something that's pretty middle of the road a lot of times, or even I'll make something that's less than amazing. But it's becoming okay and less judgmental of yourself. It's less about the hard things like the skill and the time and more about when I started back up again and I was making little doodles, I had made some really amazing stuff in college. I had a wonderful professor, but I think becoming comfortable with hitting publish, even though the art wasn't all the way up to my expectation, I think that was the biggest takeaway, was just that self-love towards, you know, baby painter Sari.
There really is something when we're first getting started or even getting back into it, that every painting can feel so precious. And on the one hand, that means like it's good that we're taking it seriously, but it can also really hold us back.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that seriousness is kind of what kept me from painting for almost 2 years. I'd made stuff I was proud of and I had artist statements and we had some bigger professors come and tour our studio and it did feel really serious. And, you know, my natural personality is very silly and irreverent. And I felt like, I think it was just this conflict of who I am and sort of what the art world I thought expected of me that paralyzed me for a year and a half. So yeah, I mean, to exactly what you're saying, I think that inviting in that play and that joy and that lack of seriousness was exactly what helped me.
You mentioned this, that it took you, you know, that seriousness. Did it take you some time to find what you wanted to paint?
Yeah, absolutely. I think for a while, you know, especially when you're new and you come to art and you're exposed to so much amazing art history in college, it is such a part of your personality and who you are. You're an artist. I don't know that school does a very good job of teaching you how to really introspect and make art that you like. There's a lot of emphasis on learning how to use art to construct a message and how to understand that art is a outward facing medium and that the conversation and how the audience understands the artwork. That's a big part of making art. But from starting my own practice and really doing some self-healing and stuff, I've learned how to really answer my own needs with my art and how to make art that really makes me happy. And then I can focus on how others read it. Yeah, that's been incredibly important. And I don't know that I have a specific aha moment when that happened. I think when I started my daily challenge, letting go of making fabulous, amazing art kind of, it went out the window. I only had 20 minutes and paper and ink. So it wasn't going to happen then. But I think through my daily practice, I've given myself more opportunity to make art that really makes me happy and my inner artist really happy. And so it's been a slow process for sure.
It sounds like it really allowed you to explore, in part because you didn't have much time. You had space to explore because you're like, well, I'll do another one tomorrow. I can do this one today.
Absolutely. Yeah. And to that point, I remember even in college, I was doing, I think, my senior praxis, and we had a rotating list of professors who would come in and kind of give us critiques. And that's how that worked. And I had a professor come in, and I was pretty prolific even back in college. And I was playing with like reflection and some kind of topical things with my art.
And he said, I think it was just a throwaway comment because I mentioned this to him later and he didn't remember it. But he said, you know, oh, well, you're making a lot of art, so you can play with stuff like that. And for me, I think that really laid the groundwork for my love of a daily practice, because I feel like you said, you can just make something different tomorrow. It doesn't have to be that deep. It kind of takes the weight and the seriousness off of it so that you can play more. And I know it's different for everyone, but certainly for me, there has to be play and curiosity in my practice.
Along those same lines, like, your work is incredibly playful. Did you have to give yourself permission to be playful in both how you approached it, but also from a subject matter standpoint?
Yeah, I don't know if it was ever a concrete thought of fully giving myself permission. But yeah, I think I have had to work just because, you know, the backdrop of the art world, especially proper New York, LA art world, there is this expectation that you're saying something pivotal or groundbreaking. If you're not saying something that's changing the world, you're not saying anything. And I understand that desire. I think that's an important thing to have. But if it's the dominant thought when you sit down and make your art, especially as a young artist or a green artist, that's going to crush you. And so for me, it was less about giving myself permission and more about shielding myself from that weight. And I think naturally what sprung out of that was a lot of play and silliness, because that's just kind of who I am. I think, you know, if you knew me in real life, I'm very silly. I love playing with my kids. I love puns. Like, I'm just a big, goofy, colorful person. And so that's the kind of art I make now.
It also sounds like for you, you were able to figure out what you like and what you don't like. How important is that piece of it as an artist to know what they like and what they don't like?
I think it's incredibly important. I think it's important for me because I don't know that I would be committed enough to make art if I didn't like it. And I know that sounds really selfish or childish, that if it's not fun, I don't want to do it. But so much of being a grown up and a parent is doing stuff you don't like. And so what I love about my studio practice is that it feels like some days, especially, it's the only place where I can do something just because I want to do it. And so it's really special to me. Of course, I love the art I make and it kind of comes together like a cohesive form, but it really for me is just an outlet and it's a way to express that more irreverent, fun, self-nurturing part of myself more so than it is a big statement.
You know, we talked in the tech call about you have such a distinctive style, and so people will come to you asking, how do you find your style and what advice do you give them? I mean, how, there's so many options out there from a painting standpoint. How does someone find their style?
Okay, yes. So there's a couple of different things I think that are important to remember when you're finding your style. So one of them is that, especially before we have an established practice, we think of art from a product consumer type mindset, which is like you see this finished product, right? And so I think if you try to reverse engineer it that way, you're like, okay, I have to pick which product I make and then commit to that. And that's going to be my style. I think style kind of comes from the other direction. And so it's really important to, instead of focusing on making this finished product, focus on what kind of a practice suits you. What do you want to be spending your day and your time doing? And I know that sounds easier said than done. And for me personally, it was a lot of introspection and mindfulness and work being quiet. And personally, like, therapy has been really helpful. I think a lot of people think that all the work that we do as an artist is with the technique. And I love that stuff. I love technique and skill. But I think the most work I've done has been introspecting and being mindful about what I like and what brings me joy and what feels sustainable and honest. And I'm not making for other people or for ego. I'm making it just because something I want to say or something that feels good. And again, I know this sounds like very obvious, but you would be surprised when you talk to artists. A lot of times they don't know what kind of artist they want to be in the sense of like what they want to make and who they want to be like. But it's that quiet introspection that I think brings the most to your creative practice.
Yeah. And that really can, like, those questions are hard questions to ask in the beginning. How did that evolve as you evolved?
I mean, for some background, I grew up below the poverty line. My mom worked for a warehouse and, you know, my dad really struggled with like addictions. And so my childhood was very tumultuous, to say the least. And whenever I, again, going back to like 2014, 2015, during that time, I had to become really intentional with how I was living my life. In school, I was very much a perfectionist. So I made amazing grades and I was a top all-region student athlete. I was performing really, really well, but it was all for other people. because I wanted to be seen as better than my circumstances. And so whenever I got out, I felt so lost not having that framework. I didn't know who I was. I knew I wanted to be good at stuff. I wanted to be loved and accepted. So I had to go to therapy and I had to really ask those questions in therapy. Who am I? What do I like? What should I do for me? And I don't think everyone has to have that dramatic of a fall apart to find themselves. But I do think those questions are important to ask yourself just in general. And of course, that found its way into my art practice. But I think it's that intentionality that's made my art practice something that I love so much. And it brings me so much joy. And it's my absolute favorite thing to do.
Is something sort of incredible and surprising about committing to an art practice that it demands a lot of the person just to make space for themselves and to ask maybe for the first time in their life, like, what do I want? That can be pretty daunting.
Absolutely, it can. I think it's because the culture and society we're in, you can go your whole life without asking that, which after five, almost 6 years of asking myself that sort of daily in regards to my practice, it's crazy that you can do that. But it's important work to do because things that are sustainable and that are going to help and serve you in the long run, I think they answer to those questions, right? If you know the answer to what makes you happy, who is your best self? What do you want to do? What is your purpose? What is your passion? I feel like we become better parents and partners and friends and coworkers in every facet of our life.
So you had formal training, but do you have to have formal training to be an artist?
Oh, no, definitely not. No, and I'm passionate about that. I think someone who has those bigger questions answered and less technical skill, it maybe even virtually no technical skill, would be a better artist than someone who has an amazing grasp on realism, you know, wonderful technical stuff, and has none of those big questions answered. I think being an artist is that desire to make something that's honest and true and genuine and authentic, and then share it with the world, and it resonates with people. My best analogy for art is you're playing catch, and it's not going to land with everyone. Not everyone's going to catch it. But when you put something out in the world and that target audience who resonates with it receives that message, it's like the best feeling in the world. So definitely you don't. I have classical training because that's sort of where my path led me. And I really enjoy having those skills in my toolbox, but those skills don't make me an artist.
Also, one of the things that's really neat about art is, like you just said, those are skills and those are tools. And the great thing about skills and tools is that they are learnable.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's, you know, with my Instagram account, and obviously I've this past year made Not Sorry Art School, which is a learning thing. But the part of the reason I've been so interested in sharing process and technique on my account is it's for that reason. You know, I want it to be accessible. I want it to be for everyone. I think it's kind of weird how it feels like to some extent, a lot of these skills are gatekept a little bit. Obviously you can go on YouTube and follow people and learn that way. But, you know, even down to the fact that a lot of times when you tell someone you're an artist, one of the first questions people ask is, oh, did you go to school? Are you trained? And I just think it's weird that instead of asking to see the work, that's your first question, that someone has to have vetted you to make you able to do something like art. You know, it's just weird.
Yeah, you can't see me, but I'm just like shaking my head. That is weird.
Right? I mean, it's not like you're a brain surgeon, you have to pass a bar. Like, it's art. Like, it's very low stakes type thing. I mean, it's important work, but I don't know. It's a weird thing.
Let me back up a little bit. So let's talk about materials and process a little bit. So what medium do you paint in and why?
Predominantly, I paint in acrylic. And part of that's because that's what I was trained in school. And I'm just familiar with it. My process leans to that. But, you know, I always think of acrylic and oils as cousins, you know, where watercolor, just the way it forms is so different. And so recently in the last like year and a half, 2 years, I've been playing with oil more. And in fact, for the last month or so, most of my work has been oil, but I teach in acrylic and I still feel like I'm an acrylic painter.
Well, yeah, you said you teach in acrylic. What about acrylic makes it good for learning?
It's a fabulous medium for learning. I was very intentional when I set up my course with acrylic. So, you know, acrylic, the big difference between it and oil is that it dries much faster. And obviously that initially that can be a really burdensome quality for the paint to have, especially if you're trying to blend. But I think it's really good because, you know, especially if you're painting realism and you're wanting to have a really good understanding of how to convey three-dimensional form and shape on a two-dimensional surface, the fact that acrylic dries so fast and you have to be really intentional with like blending and mixing on your palette and then applying it to your canvas, because of that challenge, I think it makes people have to learn that skill a little bit faster. But everything else about acrylic is really beginner friendly, right? So it's less toxic, the cleanup's a little easier. If you're new and you mess up a lot, which I still mess up all the time, it's part of my process, you just wait 10 minutes and you can paint right over top of it. So it just feels a lot less precious, but it's a little bit more challenging in the way that I think helps painters grow.
Also, I really like that, I don't know, this is a little bit off the topic, but what I like that you said that like we're allowed to fix mistakes. And if our medium helps us do that, even better.
Yeah, I think people get really precious about painting. When I share a piece of work, I'm not sharing my reference photo and like every single step in between. I mean, sometimes I'll share process photos, but that's a tertiary thing. But you're not showing receipts. That's not how art works. Your world and everything you're creating is beholden to the canvas, and that's it. So the beauty of that is if it deviates from your reference or you're painting from life or it's not exactly what you aimed for, that's totally fine. You can let go of that. There's no right or wrong. Like, you know, I was a student athlete for a long time and a runner specifically. And that whole process is so incredibly objective. There is no way of bluffing it. You start on the start line and you finish exactly at your time. But what I love about painting is it's so opposite of that, right? You have so much creative freedom. And if you make mistakes and it takes you 3 years to finish something, it doesn't matter. You're not posting that on your plaque. You know, Sari Shrike acrylic took 5 years to make. It's art and that's all it is. And that's beautiful.
Well, then what do you use? Heavy body or fluid acrylics? What kind of acrylics do you use?
Mostly Golden and some Liquitex heavy body acrylic paints. It's very similar to oil in that way. The viscosity is really similar. A lot of my finished work does have quite a bit of texture, and I use some molding paste and stuff if I want to really build up that oil-like finish. But yeah, I love those paints.
How many colors do you generally use? Do you have a limited palette or do you change per painting?
I have a pretty tried and true set of colors I use now. I do play around a lot with limited palettes because I think it's, you know, I'm always just trying to challenge and grow. And so like dabbling in the Zorn palette, or one thing I'm really loving right now is doing little plein airs with the primary colors. So yellow, magenta, and cyan. But yeah, so if do you want me to go through the colors on my palette?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I use titanium white and then cad yellow light, cad yellow medium, yellow ochre. And then I have cadmium red. And sometimes I'll use pyrrole orange. That's been my most recent art crush, is that specific color. It's like almost a cool orange. So it makes pinks really, really fun. And then alizarin crimson, quinacridone magenta, dioxazine purple, and then ultramarine blue, phthalo green, and either Hooker's or Jenkins green. I love those colors.
Oh man, you have some really lovely bright colors.
Yeah, it's high chroma. I don't think having black or brown on your palette is bad for sure, but I really love mixing my own neutrals. And in fact, one of the pieces of advice I always give artists who really struggle with making mud is, you know, if you mix your own browns and neutrals, you'll learn really quickly how to not get browns and neutrals because you know how to get there, right? So you'll know that the fact that phthalo means green, well, if you're wanting to make a really pretty violet, don't use phthalo blue because it's going to have green and it's going to muddy up the warm red tones in whatever you're choosing. So yeah, I love high chroma. It's my favorite.
So let's talk about process. Could you walk us through your process?
So a lot of my process takes place outside of my studio. I feel like I'm always on the hunt for anything that inspires me. Again, I think that really answers to my daily practice because some things like, oh, it's an orange on the counter can just be practice one day, just meeting my daily practice quota. And then other days I can find something in my life that feels like a true masterpiece. And some things have their set series of work. So it's like West Texas and I go out to Texas to find art. And then other days it's just, you know, my kids' toys strewn on the ground. So I will take pictures on my iPhone and paint from those reference photos. And I get a lot of people asking about painting from life versus painting from photo. And I certainly learned how to paint from life. I did a lot of life painting in college and in plein air, and I still will do quite a bit of plein air. But I think if you know kind of what you're doing and how to handle an image from painting from life, that painting from photo isn't dramatically different. But then once I get some photos I like, I save them to a file on my phone. And when I sit in my studio, I'll look at my canvases, and a lot of them are pre-primed. And I'll sort of just see what I feel like painting, and I'll start that. And the other part of my process is that I usually have, you know, anywhere between 2 or 3, even as many as 10 different paintings going at once. I really struggle with the middle of a painting just because it's a little bit boring. And as we referred to earlier, I really have a hard thing doing things that aren't fun. So I'll rotate between paintings and sort of get through a little bit of a middle of a painting, and then I'll go finish another painting, which is really exciting. So it's just kind of in my studio, I have a couple different stations. I have my desk and my wall, and I'll just kind of hop back between two of them. And I spend about anywhere between 2 and 5 hours a day painting, depending on what's due and what I'm working on. And I'll work through it, and then I'll post something to Instagram or send it to clients or put it on my mailing list. And that's kind of how I distribute it.
You mentioned that, you know, you see an orange and it may be part of a daily, you know, get the daily painting finished, or it may become something bigger. But the fact that you're always on the lookout for references, I think really speaks to how much you must always be thinking about painting.
Yeah. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because truthfully, that's maybe my favorite part about being an artist, is getting to exist in my day as if everything has the potential to be magic. I always think of painting as, it almost feels like sorcery, because you're taking something that's lifelike and you're putting it on a flat canvas. It's just so cool. But the fact that I'm making dinner, or I'm sitting on the floor playing with my kids, or I'm out on a hike, or anything from the most mundane domestic thing to the funnest adventure, everything has the capacity to be art. And I think, you know, it sounds like, oh, well, it's exhausting, your brain's always on, but kind of getting back to that mindfulness idea of when you're present and everything has the potential to be art, your day feels different. It's like almost getting to slow things down and take in the moment. And obviously I'm not perfect. Some days it's a mess and I don't look for art, but I have a series, it's a never ending body of work, and it's my laundry basket. So where my laundry pile is, because I wish I just kept up with my laundry, but I don't. But it's in a window with beautiful light, and my kids will sometimes turn it into forts. And I know it's chaos, but I love it so much. And so I have a wall. I do them all on paper, and I have a wall where it's just every couple of days I'll put one on there. And it's that thread of it's your life. And maybe it's not Starry Night by Van Gogh, but it's still beautiful and it's still worth making art over.
I think sometimes we get stuck in different places. Like when someone doesn't know what to paint, like where we get stuck may not be actually where we're stuck. So if someone is getting stuck not knowing what to paint, what maybe they need to do is think about the step before that, and they need to start looking for more things to paint in their life.
Lowering the bar. Again, it's that perfectionist thing. It's that we expect that we have to make some big statement. And if that's your goal, if you're really wanting to make a statement about something, some political thing or social thing, you can get there. That is an excellent goal to have. Write it on a whiteboard. But you have to start somewhere. Like, how do you eat an elephant? You start with one bite at a time. For me, that's certainly played out with art. And I don't think the creativity of choosing what to paint happens on your canvas necessarily. I think that happens in how you live your life and what you consider art and, you know, the bigger part of being an artist.
Do you only ever paint from photographs you've taken?
I do now. So that's the short answer. But in the very beginning, when I started my account, I would paint things from like Pinterest. Again, I wasn't selling art. It was really just for practice. But the responsibility of growing your platform and becoming more professional, yeah, that's been something I've made a pretty strong threshold for myself. I will say there are a couple exceptions. One of them is my mall series, which I'll play with them in Photoshop, but I exaggerate these old malls and add stuff to them. And so that's kind of a hybrid of a technically a reference photo from online. And the other thing is I have this small series of painting screens. So it is going back to everything being fodder for art, but I get my screen report on Sundays. I think it's just an iPhone feature, but I always end up being shocked at how much time I spend on my phone. It's like ridiculous. But if every week you spent that much time in a physical location, I always think, wouldn't that be part of something that you maybe made into art? Wouldn't that be a candidate for art? And since screens are a visual tool, I have a series of work that I make from screens, and it's nothing crazy. It's like MSN little screen things from like the 90s and memes occasionally. But yeah, for the most part, it's my own references, but I have a couple of slight exceptions to that.
But then it sounds like you start then to do some of that compositional thinking when you're getting your reference.
Yeah, I think so. I think even when I'm looking around, I'll do that. So another thing that I've been doing recently is finding fabric off Etsy and ordering little square foot of fabric, painting the patterns as an underpainting, and then painting on top of it and sort of just seeing what pops through and just sort of seeing how that meshes together. It's still like a project that's in its early stages, but I think there's a little bit of that. I mean, some of my work is just true blue, gets an orange on a counter and I paint everything in that composition. But my still life series and some of my newer stuff, I'm enjoying playing around with that a little bit more.
What do you paint on? You've mentioned canvas and paper. Are those the two primary ones?
Predominantly, I paint on wood panels. So the Da Vinci brand wood panels, I think I get them from Jerry's. I'll buy those in bulk and then I'll prime them with a matte, golden flat what are they called? It's a new series, but it's the Golden Flats. And I'll paint them in a really vibrant color just because I paint really high chroma and I like the way it looks. But I'll go ahead and get those ready. And then sometimes when I'm painting a little bit larger, I'll paint on canvas because I don't mind the texture of the tooth when I'm painting anything over 18 by 24-ish. And then, yeah, I do some really small studies and stuff on paper and on canvas pad. It just kind of depends. I have all of it ready to go in my studio. And when I'm looking through my photos or when I have an idea, the nice part about having like a big real deal grown up art studio is all that stuff is handily available. So just kind of depends.
How do you get the reference drawing onto your board?
I freehand it. So sometimes if I do really big canvases, like I'm staring at a Barbie aisle one that's 48 by 60. So it's super jumbo. I'll grid it. I'll make like 12 or 16 cells and then I'll throw it on there. But I really like my freehanded drawing because I'm not super caught up on it being hyper realistic or super honest in that way. I don't mind, even when I do portraits, you know, you would think with portraits it'd be different, but I don't mind it being slightly off. You know, going back to that, being grateful myself and my humanness and who I am, I think that's one of the ways that I sort of technically implement that philosophy is I'm painting a flower and like maybe it isn't perfectly what the reference photo is. It's close. I have a lot of skill at this point. I'm a pretty good draftsman, but I find that those little mistakes I make, sometimes I'll go back around and refine it and I'll be like, I actually really like how off that is. It's going to show through in the end, or it just gives me the chance to have a dialogue with the less perfect part of myself. And so, yeah, I freehand. I'm looking at the reference photo and, you know, I get close, but I don't mind it not being perfect.
Do you bring up one object at a time to completion, or do you bring up the whole painting at the same time?
Whole painting at the same time. That's a little bit of my training as far as working up and down the value scale. So that's my primary mode of how I'm thinking about the painting when I'm constructing it is, you know, I'll do my drawing, which the color of the drawing and the background are just total random colors. But then I will try to bracket my values. And so I'll go in with the darkest value that I want on the canvas. And that's actually something I learned. I've been really fortunate to take a bunch of classes with Zoe Frank and Mia Bergeron and Felicia Forte. But I learned this from Zoe Frank. But you bracket out your values in advance, and then you can use that to dictate your color. Because the one thing about color, like, it seems really indulgent and like you have no restraint when you use a lot of color. But in fact, in order to earn that level of saturation, you have to be really diligent with your value and to some extent your drawing and stuff. And you need some planning in order for it to work. But I'll just work up and down the value scale to begin to carve out the form. But I definitely don't work one object at a time. But let's say it's a looser composition, like I don't need to refine it. If I made one part of the painting really refined and polished it, I wouldn't have the ability to sort of stop it when it's at that lovely impressionistic kind of phase. So it's also a control thing.
Could you explain a little bit more about bracketing your values? What does that mean and what does that give you as a painter?
So value for me has been one of my, I would say, weaker spots. I mean, not as much now, but the last few years, I've been really intentional with it. And when I took that class, the way Zoe was talking about it, when you bracket, you're saying, I'm only going to go as light as this, you know, some scale of 1 to 10, 10 being bright white, you know, let's say you're keeping it a little bit more low key or darker, saying when you're planning it on your first go through, okay, I'm only going to make my lightest value an 8. And the most of the light values are going to live somewhere in the 6, 7 range. And then I will go all the way down to a 9. And so if I do a larger painting where I'm really interested in the finished product and it's not for practice, it's like a real painting, I will do a study. And the predominant thing that I'm working through is that value. So do I want it high key? Do I want it low key? How much control do I want to have? Because when you focus on value, and even if you do like a black and white study or something, it gives you the chance to be more luscious with your colors without it looking like completely unhinged, which I'm not opposed to an unhinged painting, but just I want to have control.
Thinking about value and how you bring up your painting, do you work then light to dark or dark to light, or you use the term chroma, like your lowest chroma colors and then toward highest chroma? Like, how does that sort of interaction work?
I think it's important to talk about how I learned it because it's a little different than how I do it now. So in college, we learned to work from low value up and then low chroma. And I still mostly will start with that just as like an entry point. But just because I've done it so much, it's a little more free range. So I wouldn't have known this if I hadn't started recording my process. And I started doing that like a year or two ago. And I realized that I might start with low saturation or low chroma and low value and then work up initially, but it goes off the rails pretty quick. What I do is I will use one large paintbrush for as long as humanly possible. There's a little bit of technique to it, but also because I tend to be kind of a lazy blender and a lazy person in general. But because of that, I'll have red on my brush, like a low saturation red. And I'll use that to bring down a green. I'll use the existing paint on there and I'll hop over to like a green area. And I'll use that to sort of bring that down. And so there's a lot less order to it once I get started. It always feels like kind of a wild blur. But my decision making is largely what's on my brush, where can I use this? And then when I push that to its full extent, where my brush is too big or maybe my brush is too dirty, then I'll switch brushes, which also going off of that, I do generally work, especially with acrylic, from low saturation to high saturation. Because again, with color, it seems like it's this luscious thing where you're just kind of painting with whatever and there's no control. But in order to get bright colors to work successfully, and I know that's a subjective term, but you have to kind of sneak up on it. Like if you start out of the gate with high chroma, especially everywhere in your composition, you end up looking blown out and you don't really have control. But I find that when you start low saturation generally and move up in saturation, just like with value, you can really make those last pops of color count and you can have more control and it looks a little less chaotic.
Listening to you talk, I'm so struck by there's this sense when you look at someone's work who is super colorful work and super playful, that is somehow comes to be through quick, no thinking, just pure intuition, boom. And yes. It turns out that's not true.
I like when things look really effortless and I don't mind that. I think that's actually loosely what I'm going for in a lot of different ways, but there is a lot of planning and it's because I've made so many paintings where I've blown out the color or saturation way too early. That's the benefit of daily painting is you can have a painting that completely implodes because you went way too light, way too early and it's you learn your lesson. But I think it's whenever you have the parameters and the framework. I think of it when you're playing bumper lane bowling, you have the little bumpers. Whenever you have the bumpers of practice and a strategy that sort of keeps you from going off the rails, within that, you can be really fun and free. And I think it's just having that balance. And it's going to be different for everyone. And to some people, my work is going to seem like garish and lush and way out of left field. But yeah, there is some planning because it isn't quite fauve. It's just on the edge of that for me personally.
How important was it for you to find a repeatable set of steps you walked through to create a painting?
I think it was pretty important because a lot of my paintings in the beginning of my daily painting practice, I published them even though I didn't love them. And I think what it was, instead of giving up or getting mad at myself, it was just, okay, what can you control? Like you can't hit a button and become a way better draftsman, or you can't hit a button and all of a sudden paint perfect local color. You can't do that. But instead of giving up on myself, I sort of learned how to work within my strengths and my weaknesses. And once I learned how to navigate those, then I was allowed to play more. Again, the core of all of this is I love doing fun things. And so by coming up with those parameters, you know, despite not being a very type A person, but they gave me the freedom to play and to not have my painting go off the rails or to play and be colorful without it being something that I sort of perceive as like too crazy, even for me. So yeah, very important.
Turning to color, what's the biggest challenge you see your students facing when it comes to color?
It's tough because, again, color is really, really subjective. I know because I put on my artwork online. Like sometimes what I'm doing with color makes people's skin crawl. And then for other people, it's like not enough color even. So my thing is first having them identify where roughly do they want their paintings to aim. Do they like the fauvist's work or do they want Hudson River School perfectly local color? But within that, I think a lot of times people are scared of bright color. And I see some students really, they buy a lot of tubes of paint to sort of compensate for maybe not fully perfected mixing skills, right? A limited palette can be really helpful if students are struggling with that. And just familiarity. I mean, honestly, the biggest thing, because I would have to kind of sit with each student and work on their specific stuff. But the biggest thing that people need to do, I think, is spend a lot of time mixing colors. My painting professor in college, his little phrase, and he was so eccentric, he would do it like a cheerleading cheer. But he would say, you don't know what you got till you put it on the spot. And it's so true because a lot of what color mixing is just that rote learning and mixing and trial and error until they've learned and navigated their specific palette. So, you know, it always feels like a bummer because people want shortcuts or they want color recipes that are going to change their life. And like, gosh, I wish there were shortcuts too, but it's just a lot of effort.
Isn't that the truth?
I know. I feel like the bearer of bad news. It's always so sad. And some things are interesting tricks and shortcuts. And if you're not good at drawing, make a grid, use a projector. That's fine. But color mixing, there's no robot for that yet. And I'm so sorry, but you just have to put in the work.
You can almost buy any color. Do you suggest students learn how to mix their own color as opposed to adding another tube of paint to their collection?
I totally sympathize with this because I've always loved color. And I think if I wasn't so poor when I started out, I would have definitely been the kind of student to have all the colors. And it's tough because you really have to learn and become familiar with your specific color setup. I think that familiarity is what helps you when you're out on the field, aka in the middle of a painting. If you know loosely how to get to a low intensity blue gray, if you already sort of know, okay, I'm going to start with ultramarine because phthalo is so bright and I'm going to mix it with, I'm going to start with my orange and throw in a red and bunker's green. Like if you already loosely know that information, it's easier for you to get to the color that you're eyeballing than it is to go through and try to pick out the color that you already have. Plus that ability to understand and know how to mix a color, not only is it going to create a cohesive palette and it's helpful in lots of those ways, but it's like the true work of being a painter. If mixing color is you don't like it, I mean this in like the most loving way, perhaps try a different medium. It's just, that is the core of what painting is. And I'm not saying it's like always going to be easy or like you shouldn't. It is challenging, but like it's the best part of the challenge.
Well, then is vibrant color about palette mixing, or is it about relationships of color on the canvas, or both?
Oh, absolutely. Color on the canvas. Color that seems really bright on the canvas and seems like it's glowing off the page. You may go up to it and look at it real close, and it's not like if you bring another color up to it, it's not actually that bright. Color is such an illusion. We joke sometimes I'm a professional optical illusionist because a lot of what you do is sort of learning how to mix color to live in the neighborhood on your painting it's going to live in. And so I'm trying to think of a good example of that. If I'm doing a beach scene and it's got this high sunny saturation, a color that's going to read really cool amidst all those bright warms is going to be really bright and warm on a painting that leans really cool. So that's why color mixing is so important. It's about learning how a color is going to make sense on your canvas. And so do you need to really bring up the color, or do you need to start in with a lower saturation, everything else? Like that lesson is exactly why I have to start so low saturation, is because I want, let's say I'm painting a magnolia and I really want that purpley violet of the shadow of magnolia leaf to sing off the page. If I want that, I have to sort of go into it knowing if you want that purple to really sting, you have to make all of your leaves lean green and lean low saturation. And you need to have all of those, the lit part of the leaf, you need them to all be really buttery and yellow, because it's only with that contrast and sort of loose planning that that color is going to make sense. Or you're just going to be trying to layer the most pure ultramarine. And if you don't have the rest of the composition working with you, then it's going to fall flat. And that's such a frustrating feeling. I've totally been there. But yeah, it definitely takes planning and knowing how to layer colors like that.
Also, listening to you talk about this, I'm just so struck by, there is so much knowledge that you bring to a painting, and you had to learn that. But also it is like you bring a lot of knowledge to the colorful paintings you create, and you can create those colorful paintings because of that knowledge.
There's, I guess, a theme here. It seems like you're just mixing all the colors and it's just showing up colorful. But you know what's so funny? I have a 5-year-old, and about a year ago, I think it was 4-ish, he did this thing that I feel like is pretty universal, which is you get paints out and you're just so excited by all the colors that you mix all of them together. And instead of getting this beautiful rainbow kaleidoscope mega color, you just get brown. And I feel like you can kind of mimic that in your own paintings if you're not careful. You can be aiming for this bright, saturated, beautiful thing. And if you don't plan and sort of think a little bit and have some knowledge of how color and light works, you're going to end up with a painting equivalent to a flat brown. And it's such a bummer because I feel like the people drawn towards color, that's a hard lesson to learn. But yeah, a lot of practice, a lot of planning, a lot of patience goes into that.
There's also a real sense of forward and back, like you lay the groundwork for later, which again, yes, takes a lot of trial and error.
Yeah. And it's funny because I just took a class with Mia Bergeron and she was talking about that too. So one of the ways I work forward and backwards, not only in that more literal sense of background and then layering forward physically through the painting, but that you have to sort of be okay with tearing apart your painting in order to go forward. So for my style, it's a lot of times I'll use redraw lines. And so there are these lines that I put in there to sort of, you know, when you do a layer and the shape and form of what you're doing becomes a little bit fuzzy and wonky. You just go back in with thinned out acrylic paint. For me, it's a random color. You know, it could be different for everyone. But you go back in and you sort of carve out that shape again. You know, if you've really messed up, let's say you were just so far off on your drawing and your value, you can use that really heavy-handedly and sort of just smudge it out with a bright red or something. Because it's acrylic, you can go back in 10 minutes later and rework that. But that ability to sort of not be precious is, I think, incredibly helpful. Not only like in a daily painting, you can do something tomorrow kind of way, but even within the painting. And it's funny because a lot of times when I do that really aggressive marking things out and I really messed up, a lot of times my best, most interesting work will come out of a painting that's full of that. And to your point, the ability to work forwards and backwards and sort of deconstruct and reconstruct is a really wonderful element to play with in your paintings.
When you're looking at something, how are you thinking through that from like a value and saturation and color standpoint? Like, what's that thinking in your mind look like? And then how does that get translated?
You know, when you're painting, especially if you're not overly committed to everything being perfectly representational and really, really strict local color, if you're okay with playing around a little bit, I always think of it like games. And so one of my favorite games to play in regard to something having direct sunlight on it is I will make that really warming and cooling based. I use it sort of as like my guide rail when I'm working through a painting. So if it's like a still life and it's on a whiteboard and it's out in direct sunlight, I will take all of the things that are in shadow and I will try not to mess with the value too much, but I will really cool down everything. So, you know, a shadow in real life is really truly gray. I swear that they lean slightly cool, but my husband tells me it's gray. So in real life, it's gray. But if I'm playing that warming cooling game, that lit, not lit game, I will take that and I will add ultramarine and maybe a little bit of violet to it. And then I'll pull it back from being too high chroma with a nice orange or yellowy orange. And I'll pull it that way so it's slightly cool of a neutral blue. And then in the light, I will take something that's right next to it. I will pull it slightly warm. And I start with just slightly in each direction. And as I work through the painting, I'll find opportunities where I can really exaggerate that. I can make a shadow very high chroma and it still makes sense. And I learned a lot of that from just trial and error. And the fact that I love using direct light is kind of just part of why I've become so familiar with that exact strategy. But you can do this with a lot of different ways. And one of the more sophisticated versions of that color light game I play is with my, I have a series of work that I do of grocery aisles in Walmart. And I always joke that there's like this very specific Walmart light green tint. I don't know what it is, if it's the skylights or who knows. But I will then take all of my color lighting decisions and I will slightly tweak it in that direction. And it's different than just adding a glaze, right? It's not some removed part of the process that slightly tints things, but it's more of a way of when you're picking your color, you're saying, okay, this is a blue object, but it's lit. So all of a sudden you're dealing with actually a green object, but it's getting this bounced light from this orange. And you might end up with a color, like it might be a blue object, but now you're dealing with this greeny yellow. But within the game that you're playing, it's going to make perfect sense. So I'm very much not beholden to local color. And it's through playing those games that you can get with these colors that are totally not realistic, but they make sense within the context of your entire composition.
Well, then, if someone came to you and said that they wanted to get really good at painting, what advice would you give them?
Figure out what you love doing, what your ideal subject matter is. And it doesn't have to be perfect. It just means what you're okay spending a couple hours doing, what your ideal practice looks like. Do you want the accuracy that realism provides, or do you want the play and intuitiveness that abstract provides? Figure that out and then show up every day. Or I mean, I guess it doesn't be every day, but as much as you can within what you're doing, right? So for me, it's daily, and for other people, it's going to be different, but show up as much as you can. And I think starting there, to keep it short and sweet, I would say that. But I think from that, an honest practice doing something you love, you'll eventually know what to look for in terms of skill and bettering yourself and inspiration. Like all of that will come if you do the core of what being an artist is, which is practicing and putting in the hours.
You can learn more about Sari Schreck, including her classes, at her website, www.sari.studio, or on Instagram and Facebook, and we'll link to everything in the show notes. Thank you so much for joining us today, Sari.
Thank you so much, Kelly.
Thank you for joining me this week on the podcast. Head to learntopaintpodcast.com/podcast/episode40 for show notes. Before you go, click like and subscribe on your listening app. And if you've got a few more minutes to spare, leave a review of the show. This helps other artists find the show, and it makes a big difference. Speaking of big differences, a big thank you to everyone supporting on Patreon. You make this show possible. Thank you to High Gloss supporters Andrew Atterbury, Debbie and Brian Miller, Janet Wheeler, and Rihanna DeRold. Happy painting!